Okay, so moving on to today's speaker, it's a great pleasure to introduce Alex, who did his Alex Lees, who did his undergraduate and PhD at University of East Anglia with Carlos Perez, and then postdocs at the Museo Golgi in Belém in Brazil, and at Cornell. And then since then has been a lecturer and more recently a senior lecturer in tropical ecology at Manchester Metropolitan University.
Okay, thank you, Yadvinder, and thank you again for the introduction to come talk to you guys today. So I guess in the sort of taxonomy then of scientists or ecologists, perhaps I'm a tropical ecologist or perhaps I'm an ornithologist or a landscape ecologist that sort of uses birds, I guess, to answer a lot of ecological questions. But I think, to be honest, I'm like a sort of total bird nerd who uses ecology as a means to see birds, and I guess... what drives our own, what we do, I guess, can often be driven by sort of personal preferences or what we'd like to be doing in life. But I guess I'm questioning those life choices now. I'm spending most of my time marking exams rather than doing field work, so maybe you'll be rethinking that. But so, anywho, I've spent a lot of the last 15 years or so working in the Amazon Basin, most of the last 9 working with these good folk up here as part of the Sustainable Amazon Network, which is not something I'm going to be talking about terribly much today, but I thought, given we have a new shiny all-dancing website, that I'd better mention it. So some of you probably heard of some of the work of our own work, sort of Joyce and Joss and Toby and Erica, who's in the back here, and Cesar and myself. And the sort of my day job, I guess, for much of the last 9 years then, has been doing sort of ecosystem accounting exercise, is looking at the value of multiple land use types for biodiversity and ecosystem services and economic development to an extent. So just sort of looking at what occurs where, essentially. And in that process, I guess I mentioned earlier that, you know, I sort of ended up doing tropical ecology. I thought this was going to be a means that I was going to spend lots of time, in lots of exciting places surveying birds. And in fact, I spent quite a large amount of that time in ecologically terribly depauperate areas, such as this field of grass in the southern Amazon. And having sort of spent 5 years in Brazil, over to the States, and I find myself back in the UK in landscapes which are quite functionally similar and also massively depauperate here in the Peak District. So if anyone wants to talk about rewilding afterwards, then that would also be a pleasure. But I'm not talking about either of those things today. I guess many people in this room have heard of the 7 deadly sins. I think I can't remember what most of them are. Maybe it was peat hacking and pseudo replication or something. But I'd imagine that some of you probably heard of the 7 biodiversity shortfalls. Has anyone come across Paul Tower L's paper? A couple of names. So I find this as a really interesting mechanism to think about what we know and what we don't know about biodiversity. Something I often teach in lectures to undergrads, and I think it's quite a tangible way of thinking about what we need to know and what we do know and don't know. So these shortfalls, which you can probably create several more, indeed we did create an extra one in a paper recently in review, I might mention that a bit later on, but key ones then are, what we know about the diversity of life on Earth, so taxonomy essentially, how many species are there, evolutionary patterns, so relationships between species, species distribution, so where is life on Earth distributed, the abiotic tolerance of species, the abundance and relative abundance of species, species traits, and finally biotic interactions. There's not necessarily a purposeful order there, though I think to a certain extent we know a lot more about what we have rather than how those species interact with each other. So if you think about in terms of what we do and don't know, I think if we go along this talk, we start to know less and less and less, essentially. So first question, then, how many species? So most of the work I do then with birds, which are arguably, in fact probably not even arguably, the best known of all terrestrial biota, certainly the most well studied and probably with the best information about perhaps any of these different categories of sort of knowledge gaps across all taxa. So depending on your taxonomy, maybe about 10,000 bird species, maybe considerably more if we start sort of splitting out all these phylogenetic species. Again, something I'll talk about later on. But again, where are these things found then? So bird species of these 10,000, about half are exclusive to tropics, and about 91% intersect the tropics, at least in some part of their distribution of their annual cycle. So obviously lots of migratory birds which may breed at temperate latitudes, which then migrate to the tropics. So birds are really sort of one of the most sort of quintessential tropical taxa to an extent. Now, I think with many different taxonomic groups, I think it would be probably unfair to say that people are sort of cracking open new bottles of champagne for every new beetle described, because we're still so far away from the asymptote of describing new invertebrates. You know, we probably only described perhaps 10% of the invertebrate biodiversity. With birds, we're probably at something like 99.9% of all bird biodiversity described. That is to say, of species which we've never seen before. So I'm not talking about sort of splitting and lumping, I'm talking about things which no one has ever set eyes on, or at least recognised as being a population of interest. But we still do find new species of birds in the neotropics. So two examples here, the Inumbrian gnatcatcher, named after Sir Dave Attenborough there, and then this one here, just quite an interesting one, the predicted antred, Perpsilochnus predictus, so named because it was an obvious biogeographical gap in the Western Amazon, an area which didn't have an antwren in this genus, and people had even written about it, but, well, you know, why is there not one of these small canopy antwrens in the Western Amazon? And it turned out there was, and people had missed it. So essentially then, we are, you know, we've done quite well describing a lot of this bird diversity, though we still do miss things. A particular chagrin of my own was essentially overlooking a new species in one of our eastern Amazon field sites around Paragominas. So when you're doing bird work, that, you know, a lot of that is just listening to birds. When I'm doing a point count in the rainforest, I see very, very little, and most of what I'm recording is species I'm hearing. So you also have to get really good at knowing the vocalizations of bird species. And out there in 2010, I recorded a bird song which I had no idea what it was. It didn't correspond to anything I knew about, but it's also sort of a fine, high-pitched noise, which kind of, it's of a frequency which overlaps with lots of frogs and crickets, and I tried playing back to this thing and didn't see it, and I posted the recordings online, the internet, and other people said it was a different species, and I said, well, it wasn't that thing. The long, the short, and the tall of it is that eventually somebody discovered this little bird here in dry forests, further east of where we were, and it turned out to be, and it still is, an undescribed species of toady tyrant. So a tiny little bird, weighs about 3 grams, lives up in the forest canopy. And the forest canopy in a tropical dry forest in that area is only sort of 10, 15 metres, but where we were in the southern Amazon, it's like 30, 40 metres. And I did see that bird a couple of years later when it returned as part of a slide I flashed up earlier on, looking at the biodiversity valley of oil palm. Then I knew what it was and I heard it. And I got, this is my only picture of this bird, if anyone can spot it. It's pretty unlikely. So it's in this block here. We'll zoom in. And that's the bird there. So you see its breast and its little tail sticking out there. That was my best view I ever had of that thing. So the reason why this bird had been missed then by scientists is a tiny little rainforest bird, makes a noise a bit like a frog, lives in the rainforest canopy. And it's those the sort of things, our Linnaean shortfalls, the things we're missing, tend to be sort of small canopy things or nocturnal things or whatever. So the long, short, the tall is we've got a pretty good handle on most of those species. Although we are still describing new species even from the Atlantic Forest of Brazil. So an area which has a history of 400 or so years of ornithological fieldwork, we're still every decade describing new species. And obviously, as you all know, the Atlantic Forest has lost, depending on who you ask, you know, upwards of sort of 90-95% of forest cover. As we're still describing new species, these ones in red here are on the red list basically, you know, these species are being described and they're straight onto the globally threatened list. The things being described now are critically endangered, you know, straight off the bat, essentially, because they're things with tiny, tiny population sizes. And then also ask the question, well, how much have we missed? Presumably, then, we've missed a lot of species which have gone extinct, what Edward Wilson called centenarian extinctions, after a ridge in Ecuador where some botanists went in years ago, found another new plant species, and it was gone, you know, the next year or whatever. So I'd imagine that, given that we're still finding new birds in the Atlantic Forest, that historically we must have lost a lot. And we can't necessarily ever get back to that information, you know, unless we sort of try some sort of modelling exercises looking at structure of communities, or perhaps we'll find a rich vein of sub-fossils somewhere. But it is important to consider, because people have raised the idea that, well, the Atlantic Forest has lost almost all of its forest cover, and there's been very few, if any, bird extinctions. But my argument is that, A, we're currently hemorrhaging species to extinction, and this is happening, I'll talk about this in a second, but B, we probably lost a lot of species before they were ever known to science. I think that's worth bearing in mind, and Bjorn Lundberg, in his book, even mentioned the Atlantic Forest as an example of why we don't have to worry so much about the tropics, and I'd argue that that's a total fallacy. So here we have a series of brown birds. I'm afraid there's going to be a few photos of dead birds. A series of brown birds, which are all, or were all, thought to be Alagoas foliage blooms. So the most imperiled part, perhaps of any tropical forest anywhere in the New World, is the Atlantic Forest of northeast Brazil, which is its own biogeographic province with high rates of endemism. And it's lost, you know, something like 98% of all forest cover. So we just have a few forest fragments in the uplands there, and some even smaller ones in the lowlands. And the first ornithological expeditions to go to that area weren't until the late 1970s, early 1980s, organised by the Gelgen Museum, and they came back with a load of birds new to science. Amongst those was Alagoas foliage gleaner, this series of birds here. Except, you know, how many bird species have we got here? I don't know if many of you guys, you still, what you guys know about birds, or if you've looked at many bird specimens, but there's kind of a significant outlier here, which is this kind of Goliath thing here. But this passed unnoticed in that collection, even though the type series was only 9 birds, until an Argentinian called Juan Mazar Barnett, when he was in the forest in that region, he noticed there seemed to be 2 cryptically similar bird species, both sort of brown, both in the foliage gleaner group, but one of them was considerably larger with a different vocalisation and different biology as well. Spent most of its time looking for food in arboreal bromeliads, essentially. And what happened with this combination of field data and just using basically this type specimen, a new species was described, the cryptic tree hunter. So this bird was described in 2014. This is just to show you in the series as well. This is Alagoas foliage gleaner, which is endemic to the northeast. This is black cat, found in the rest of southeast in Brazil. This is this cryptic tree hunter, and this is a different species of tree hunter. So these two things are clearly in the same genus, as are these. This bird here, the cryptic tree hunter, described in 2014, was last seen in the wild in 2008. So it's an example of a recently described species of Atlantic Forest which went and gone extinct, you know, before it was described, essentially. So we're kind of now getting them to see this sort of pattern of loss in this region. And Alagoas foliage gleaner itself, this other brown bird, it was last seen in the wild in 2012. So that's almost certainly also extinct. Indeed, we passed it extinct. The Brazilian Ministry of the Environment participated in the Red List assessments for this group. And we declared extinct in 2013, which literally only a year after the bird was last seen, which you might think was a big risk of a Romeo error, what they call in conservation biology, the risk of stopping looking for something too early. But this bird is only ever known from 2 forest fragments. No one had ever found it anywhere else. And by the end of it, it was just known down to 1 individual. So in fact, our confidence in that bird going extinct, it might have seemed overconfident at the time, but no one's had a sniff of one since. And I think we can be confident that bird has disappeared because there is so little forest left in that region. And it's one of a suite then of globally endangered birds, of which 4 probably from these forests have now disappeared. And there's lots of co-extinctions going on there. So these tiny forest fragments in this region, a lot of them are on the sort of serras, on these hilly areas, surrounded by huge expanses of sugarcane, and these are drying up. And so they've had huge, huge losses of bromeliads, which are, again, a keystone species in this area, not just then for this tree hunter, which only, this sort of myopia that some neotropical birds have, these ultra-specialists, which only essentially look for food in bromeliads. There's also all sorts of other species, from, you know, invertebrates to frogs, which also need these bromeliads. So this loss of bromeliads is probably unleashing a chain of extinctions in northeast Brazil at the moment. So another example here, this is another bird known solely from the type specimen called Myrothera fluminensis from Rio de Janeiro. This bird was collected in 1982, and it's the holotype and sole specimen in existence of this species, taken from a place called Marge, just on the southern end of like the Serra do Orgaz. And this bird has been looked for and never found. Some people have seen something else that looks quite similar and suggested it was it. There was kind of all sorts of controversy. And the bird was recently delisted. It was listed as critically endangered by the IUCN, and was recently removed from the global red list because it was decided it wasn't even a species. It was an invalid taxon, and it was probably just a white-flanked anteret, a congener which also occurs in the same area. So we, along with Gustavo Bravo, who's currently at Harvard and working on the phylogeny of a lot of these antbirds, we registered the taxonomy of this species, and using a combination then of genetic evidence and morphological evidence, so ultra-conserved elements, mitochondrial DNA, we were able to show that not only was Miromaterella fluminensis, the Rio de Janeiro anteren, a good species, it's not even in the same genus as the thing it's been lumped into. So it was lumped into this group up here where are either Miromaterella axillaris, the white-flanked anterens. In fact, it's not even particularly close related to that group, and it best fits in a different genus. So again, these questions of how much have we lost and what are we losing, and the value again of these old museum specimens sort of comes out again and again and again. So our next shortfall then is this Darwinian shortfall, this idea of what we do and don't know about relationships between species. And again, birds are an example apart from most taxonomic groups, because we have like fantastic amounts of genetic information now. We have a not complete avian phylogeny, but at least we have all species plotted on a phylogeny. There's probably about 60% representation of all the species on Earth in this phylogeny, and obviously not necessarily a huge amount of within taxon sampling. So there might be only one or two specimens sequenced of each species, so not necessarily capturing all that geographic information, but still we have a working phylogeny for the world's birds, which puts us in a lot better position for many taxonomic groups. And in recent years then, we've seen something of a revolution in avian taxonomy, you know, our attempts to sort of catalogue life on Earth, because with this, armed with this genetic information, we can then reappraise species limits for lots of essentially small brown birds in the neotropical region. So lots of rainforest birds, especially in the neotropics, are characterised by being quite morphologically conservative. So they're all sort of small and brown and living in the rainforest understory. But a lot of these species have quite strong sort of vocal distinctions between populations, between subspecies, for instance. And by combining then this sort of vocal evidence with the molecular evidence, they started telling a very different story about the sort of the mismeasure, if you like, of Amazonian biodiversity. So we found out that by crossing these two data sets, things that we kind of pigeonholed as subspecies, or in sometimes cases not even recognised as being distinctive at all, have turned out to be quite deeply genetically divergent. So we probably underestimated the number of species quite drastically in the Amazon basin. And by summing up all the sort of recent splits and potential splits and inkling or people's knowledge from existing phylogenies where those individual species complex haven't been pursued, or even our knowledge of vocal differences, we may have actually underestimated by about a third the species level diversity of Amazonian perching birds, passerine birds. So this is an example, again, from the Amazon lobeur, which was formerly this, you know, pan-Amazonian species. And within each of these areas of endemism, so you can think of Amazonia as kind of like a series of biogeographic provinces, an archipelago, if you like, divided up by major rivers. Within each of these areas of endemism, we find, you know, really strong population structure and divergences we expect to be at the species level for most groups. So it's arguable whether you want to call them species, but based on this evidence, perhaps. But we have, for many of these, strong vocal differences, which is a pre-zygotic isolating mechanism. So you'd expect those things potentially not to interbreed. And then we have sort of subtle morphological differences, which is kind of the problem in itself, because historically, you know, taxonomy was, you know, a bunch of old white men essentially looking at museum specimens, and that was their only information, you know, the morphology of these birds. Now, with all these extra data sets, we can completely reappraise this and have found out that people have, you know, sort of underestimated the diversity of Amazonian birds and indeed of Southeast Asian birds. And the taxonomy of Southeast Asian birds is a long way behind that of what we know about birds in the neotropics. And again, this is important because if we end up subdividing these things and we're creating all these new species, then we have to think about our systematic conservation planning. You know, if we've something's gone from 1 to 3, you know, do we have a reserve there? What do we know about the future population status of these things? So these are important not just ecological questions, but conservation priority setting exercises. And just to mention, there's one kind of the straw man, the subject of a lot of argument when people have been thinking of, are these species or not, and what you want to call the species, has been what happens in the headwater regions of Amazonian rivers. So historically, you know, lots of field work was done in the lower reaches of rivers, where the rivers are very wide. In the headwaters, rivers become narrow, 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 until the point it probably ceased to become a barrier for a volant organism. Birds, intertropical birds, tend to have very, very low dispersal capacity compared with, like, temperate zone species. Indeed, some things that are reticent or even physiologically incapable of flying 50 or so metres. But still, when he gets his headwater regions, you'd expect them to be able to cross over to the other side and potentially interbreed with their congeners or subspecies pairs or whatever, and interfere with that speciation process. But what's actually been found is that when we compare sort of what you might term as bona fide Amazonian species, things that no one has ever questioned, which are extremely phenotypically different, with some of these poorly morphologically differentiated species, we found the sort of similar patterns or lack, essentially, of interbreeding in those areas. So it seems that a lot of these sort of small brown birds, when you get to those headwater regions, they are behaving as species and behaving as biological species, and we should probably treat them as such. So the upshot of this, then, we have our areas of endemism here. The upshot is that we're currently, you know, still losing. The rates of forest loss in East Amazon have slowed. Again, what will happen in the next 5 to 10 years will depend a lot on the political climate, which you all know is quite scary in Brazil at the moment. But even if we don't have huge loss of forest, there's, you know, risk of all sorts of state shifts and regime changes, Hispanization, etc., and ongoing degradation of these forests by fire and by logging, etc. And many of these species, again, mentioned earlier, to have a community of, you know, sort of 300 or so bird species in a hectare, all these species must have very, very narrow realised niches. Lots and lots of specialists. So changes in the structure of forest translates into local extinctions because you've removed those niches. So the upshot is this: we have now lots and lots of threatened species in the Eastern Amazon already, but if we go and split out all those species, then we have even more. It becomes even more of a conservation priority, which at the moment, it's not generally viewed as a major conservation priority, and that's probably because of a mismeasure then of species richness. So, last example of a set of birds. This is a big, large, terrestrial, insectivorous bird called the variegated antpitter. These birds are here, are all from the Guyana Shield, all these specimens in the British Museum. This is one from the Atlantic Forest, and this one here, which I've gone to see and photograph at the British Museum, is one from the northeast Brazil, from those forests we talked about in Pernambuco. So when I saw that specimen, I thought, well, that looks quite odd, because it looks nothing like the subspecies, if you like, of variegated antpitter, which occurs in the Atlantic Forest, and it looks quite a lot like these birds in the north bank here. This one here is the southern Amazonian one. So I teamed up with Martin Collinson to sequence this specimen here and this specimen here, and then we sequenced a load of birds in a collection of the Geldy Museum. So work carried out largely by Lincoln Carnera, the Geldy, Martin Collinson, and also Gustavo Bravo, and this is this special specimen here. This bird here turned out to be genetically identical to these ones here. So actually, and we worked into this and found out a bit more about the collector, it was actually probably a trade skin with a wrong label, and it probably came from a guy in a shield. Even more so, because there was a species of capuchin monkey also mislabeled in the same collection from northeast Brazil. Except that's probably not the end of the story, because there is no variegated antpitter in northeast Brazil, yet there is in tropical forests throughout the rest of Brazil. And it's also a bird which is extremely sensitive to forest disturbance, forest degradation. It wouldn't surprise me if there was one at one point there and it's simply gone extinct. I can't prove that, but it looks quite likely. As an aside, this bird here is different, basically, a level of like 6% of its mitochondrial DNA from these ones here. So when Martin Collinson, who does most of his work on temperate zone birds here, he heard about that sort of difference. He said, well, that's like a genus level difference. So again, you know, we could quite easily split this bird as being different from all these again. But again, this sort of speaks again to those various themes of of sort of local extinctions, potential local extinctions, and then the sort of mismeasure of biodiversity in the tropics. So our next shortfall then is a Wallacean shortfall. So essentially what we do and don't know about where species are in space and in time. So a couple of years ago then, I was leading work on oil palm, and it was in Amazon, and in and around these oil palm plantations, there were also a number of kind of open, what the locals thought were kind of open field systems, but in fact sort of dwarf, shrubby, savanna-like areas. And in that area, I found a load of bird species which had never been recorded from anywhere, basically, in the eastern Amazon basin, which I guess might not strike you as terribly novel, but in the sense that this area was only 80 kilometres south of the Gelder Museum, and somewhere which had been inventoried, you know, has a 200-year history of being surveyed by ornithologists, kind of brings home that idea of, you know, what do we really know about what's lurking where? And obviously, like, field expeditions are one way of addressing these sort of questions, but to be honest, a big source of then of these discoveries have come from citizen scientists over the last few years. Essentially, the Wikiaves is a Brazilian like photo repository, and then eBird is the world's largest citizen science initiative, gathering both images and sound recordings and checklist data. And between these two sites, essentially, we've redrawn the maps of many bird species, not just in Brazil but across the world. And it's having, you know, people out there, amateur ornithologists, birders, if you like, collecting this data, has essentially changed much of what we know about Brazilian birds and about birds in the tropics, full stop. So just to highlight, for some of you who are not aware of the eBird initiative, that it is an incredible source of data. So 600 million or so bird sightings spread through 35 million or so checklists, I think, now, covering almost all the world's species. So, and then you can sort of mainline the data straight from R, and there's a nice sort of how-to guide which has come out on the best ways to try and use this complete checklist data. It comes with all sorts of caveats, depending on where you are in the world, but I think it's a great way of sort of getting at some of these macrological questions. So a couple of examples of Wallacean shortfalls. This is a bird of prey species found in according to the books, initially throughout South America, essentially, as a resident species. A few years ago, a friend at BirdLife asked me what I knew about the sort of distribution of this bird, and because people had sort of moved at it as potentially a migratory species. And I had a quick look on that Wikiaves site, and it was immediately apparent that it was a full migrant. And no one had ever sort of realised that before, but it took me like 10 minutes to work that out looking at the internet, essentially. And so I wrote a little paper about it. So this is basically latitude against date. I think this is specimen records. This is records essentially from eBird and from Wikiaves. And this was sort of unpublished or unvouched observations. The problem was there were other species which looked quite similar. There's another bird called the bicolored hawk. Indeed, I think it was either Bates or perhaps it was Wallace years ago noticed the similarity between this species and another South American raptor and talked about it being an example of mimicry. And this mimicry also deceives bird watchers into thinking they see this species when they're seeing another one, and therefore reporting it out of season and obscuring that biogeographic pattern. But when you have these citizen science archives where you can look at unambiguous digital vouchers, then you're in a better position to assess the status of these species. So again, this idea of having photos or sound recordings has proven an excellent way of checking what we think we know about tropical birds, and checking essentially a pervasive assumption of residency in tropical birds. We now know there's a lot more migration happens, which is obviously an extremely important ecological process in itself. This is just to say that basically this species actually breeds down in southeastern Brazil. It also breeds, we found out subsequently, in the Bolivian Yungas, and then migrates to winter in Amazonia. And it's essentially absent from southeast Brazil in winter. You know, it's a species, and this is in the austral winter, obviously, when it's too cold, the insects it eats. So we basically uncovered this shortfall where people assumed it was resident, and in fact, we've been thinking about it, it's a far, far more localized species, and people were thinking, well, you know, it basically occupies most of Amazonia, and therefore it's not something we need to worry about. But actually, you know, it's a species which deserves sort of conservation reappraisal. And again, Whilst working on the maps for forthcoming field guides for birds of Brazil, I noticed several more of these. I had a chance to publish one of these whilst I was at Cornell, which is just a bird called this Astrotid cassionis. So it's a bird which is, according to the books, has a wide distribution across most of eastern Brazil, stretching all the way from Santarém, where we work in the Brazilian Amazon, all the way to Caatinga. Yet when I looked at the data for that, and again, showed an obvious pattern of this time partial migration. So basically it's in the Caatinga all year round, but then in the warmest summer months and the dry season Amazonia, it's moving into the Amazon basin. So it's kind of a first example of longitudinal migration in an intertropical bird, essentially. So this is just those different seasons here, and you can see it's basically restricted as a breeding bird to the Caatinga, and then some of them at least migrate out to winter, almost up into Amazonia state. So again, really, really simple analyses, but something that just came out of quickly flicking through some system science initiatives. So beyond that then, the idea is then to use this sort of massively crowdsourced data to try and look at the distribution of other South American bird species. So this is a complete annual cycle model based on eBird records, from what the guys who lead on this, Daniel Finke, out at the Cornell Lab, call this STEM model, so spatio-temporal explicit models. So using that checklist data, knowing when people do and don't see the species, because if you've recorded complete checklists of birds, you can build models based on land cover and based on the bird sightings to look at migration, in a neotropical bird at a global scale. And these things should be important, not just to ornithologists, but also to botanists, for instance, because these birds are also extremely important seed dispersers. Thinking in terms of restoration of degraded areas, things like fork-tailed flycatchers are using these sort of habitats, as are various other migrant and austral migrant tyrannid flycatchers, and are probably extremely important for dispersing seeds of tree species, and really important for passive regeneration of forest on degraded land. So again, sort of some very valuable ecosystem services coming from these species. And then if you can see from the eBird data then, using these sort of cake plots here, we can look at their habitat usage across the annual cycle. And then again, in the Amazon basin, they're migrating through, they're predominantly using savanna habitats, and indeed some of these anthropogenic landscapes as well. So they're using field systems and such like, perching on hedges, and could be on fence lines, etc. It could be really important for sort of driving restoration some of these degraded areas. So this is a bird called black-billed cuckoo. Do you know how many records of black-billed cuckoo there are in the winter season, winter period, December till February?
In the world?
In the world.
5,000.
It's more like five.
Five.
So no one knows, a bird which probably has about 5-6 million pairs probably nesting in the States, no one knows where this quite abundant breeding bird of the boreal belt, or of quite a large chunk of the eastern United States, breeds. I mean, it disappears somewhere in South America. Millions of them, somewhere. There's virtually no record. So even with some quite common species then, we're still facing massive whilst in shortfalls. Maybe they're all in some sort of specific habitat type, in dry forest somewhere, or in some sort of white sand forest, maybe in the canopy and no one's noticing them, but essentially this is a common North American breeding bird, and we know virtually nothing about what it's doing in winter. So this whilst in shortfall is a bit of a bugbear for me whenever I see some of these often brilliant sort of global macroological modelling exercises. I don't know if Yadvinder would comment on this, thinking about tropical tree species, but this is for birds. What do you make of this big gap in the Guyana Shield here?
Data.
I think it's lack of data. So a few years ago, some of my collaborators from the GELDI launched a big expedition. They surveyed all sorts of areas in the Calia Norte in northern Brazil there. And they found, they published a quick paper with range extensions of 60 bird species. And I think a lot of our, we come to sort of think about these sort of the Guyana Shield quite poor species richness, for instance. Actually, I think a lot of these are artifacts, which just around undersampling. And presumably, if we're missing all these species, we're probably missing a few undescribed species as well. But when I see maps like this, I often worry, what have we trusted? Do we trust this sort of Noel Kemp Mercado bias down here? And Alta Floresta and such like, and again, Terra do Meio here in southeast Brazil. I think a lot of these maps that we've come to kind of trust to a certain extent, I think can't be trusted because we don't have a lot of that data. We have a lot of problems with our geographic range polygons for birds, which are again the taxon which we apparently know best. So a last example here, this is another example of a species where we're assuming geographic range polygon filling. So this is a small brown bird called the rufous-tailed ant thrush, which apparently has a wide distribution in southeast Brazil, basically stretching all the way almost from like Espírito Santo down here into Rio Grande do Sul. If you look at the data both in eBird and in WikiAvis, it seems to have a completely disjunct distribution. There are no records in this intervening area here, and this species is a high-altitude species, which there's several replacement species in the same genus, and this only occurs above, I think, about 3,000 metres. And there is nowhere over about 3,000 metres here, but it's assumed that the species is present again. It's historically speaking, distribution maps are drawn up based on a scattering of records, and people assume that things are everywhere. Where in fact, a lot of bird species, and again, a lot of all species, are probably much more patchily distributed as well in space and time. So next shortfall then, abiotic tolerance then. So a lack of knowledge about the responses and tolerance of species to abiotic conditions, habitat, climate, soil, water, amongst others. I'm not sure if when habitat here is supposed to necessarily include like habitat structure or not. It seems some people's working definitions talk of habitat and therefore of the trees and of biodiversity as being structure. I think I'll here interpret it as those perhaps purely abiotic conditions. And it's something that obviously with reasonable data about where things are, we can build up some pretty good models. You know, it's fabulous living in this age of sort of world clearing data and being able to like farm out student projects doing these sort of things. So, you know, sort of living in it's credible time to be alive in terms of macroecology. And people go out then and build these sort of models based on bird distribution. But something like this is our Rhizus taurangulate here, plotting those records together, and then these are the actual site records of this species, and this is the predicted distribution. We get something which kind of matches reality. I can happily report for this species here that I found it in this little patch here in the middle, just south of Goiás, at my father-in-law's house. There's a small farm there, which is a really, really cool, really poorly known Brazilian bird. So there is quite a lot of utility then in SDMs, and you can build some quite interesting results. This is just a comparison that an MSc student of mine did, looking then at partial migration in a number of austral flycatchers, also quite important for these sort of seed dispersal mechanism itself. So I think we're doing quite well when it comes to sort of modelling these distributions, because we've got quite reliable then abiotic data. But a big challenge for neotropical ornithologists then is species abundances. And it's something we're not doing very well at, because it's extremely, extremely difficult to count and accurately count birds in tropical forests. At temperate zones, you can quite easily get reasonable count data. When you're doing a point count in tropical forests, you're struggling first to identify what's calling, then to count that, and to know how many individuals there are, and then to have enough replicates across enough vegetation types to really get a good handle on relative abundance becomes something which is extremely, extremely challenging. I mentioned one species here. This is a Strizeman's bristlefront, which has been on the news occasionally. It was a bird which was sort of lost and then known only from a type specimen described like 100 years ago, lost for several decades in forests in Minas Gerais and in Bahia in eastern Brazil, refound again. And now it looks like we're down to one bird, because all the fragments this species occupied are all burnt in a series of mega wildfires in the last El Nino event. We thought it had gone extinct, and then one bird has been found after a year's worth of expeditions. So it's potentially the rarest bird in the entire world, and potentially a bird which we're not struggling with our Prestonian shortfall, because we're actually quite sure there's potentially only one of them. So this is just a quick think piece I wrote for Biotropica with Doug Robinson and John Blake, talking about some of these inherent challenges about using birds as model species, simply because people see them as like a go-to taxon for field surveys, because they're cheap and easy to sample. But the problem is they are prone to a lot of error in collecting this bird data, so it's something to be wary of. So I guess then, for counting birds, it's easiest to do it with the rarer things, right? So we mentioned already Alago's foliage thing, which is extinct. Here's our ant wren here. Purple-winged ground dove still appears on the Brazilian red list as critically endangered, but actually hasn't been reliably reported anywhere since 1985. There's no documentation for that bird. People keep reporting it. I suspect actually went extinct 30 years ago. And then another good one's a kinglet calyptra. This bird was known from lots of specimens taken in the 19th century. So when I say lots, I mean 60 or 70 specimens. There's two just down the road from me in the Manchester Museum. And it's a bird was then reportedly rediscovered in 1996, but then not seen again, not seen in the interim. And I suspect also gone. In fact, might be heresy to even suggest it, but you know, there is no documentation for that bird, essentially, certainly not in the last 30 years, or you know, there is no documentation, no objective evidence that bird's continued survival. Again, a bird which was found only around Rio de Janeiro, and presumably, even though there's quite a lot of forest in that region, presumably it's a species which, at least in some parts of the annual cycle, must have used those bottomland forests. It's the only reason you could think of why the species would have disappeared, is that for some reason, some part of its life cycle, it needed the low-level forest. Because for anything, if a bird, or indeed for most taxonomic groups, if something was common in the historical specimen record, it's very hard to rediscover it. If something was known from very few specimens, you've got a chance, because that means we don't have a good idea about where that thing lived in space and time. But with things like the Calyptura and the ground dove, where we have lots and lots of historical records, that suggests something calamitous has happened, and it suggests that we can't re-find it, because we know quite a lot about its ecology. So to drum home this problems associated with sort of thinking about abundant tropical species is that if we're trying to map this at landscape scales, is that you know these species have very, very fine-tuned responses to land use change. So you know some species can be incredibly abundant or abundant in undisturbed forests and then drop off calamitously at the first sign of forest degradation, whereas you know other species, sort of gappy and edge species, can have you know quite significant population increases in areas that have been disturbed by fires and logging, etc. And then some species can kind of hold their own through all these disturbed categories of forests, do quite well in secondary forests, those forests you know regenerating from past clear cutting. So we've got lots of taxon specific responses to different land use types, but we also have within taxon responses. So this is basically a plot between our two landscapes in the Amazon, the Paragominas and Santa Fe. And for some of our species, we found one response in one region and a different response in the other one. We haven't looked into what's driving that, though I suspect it's got a lot to do with biotic interactions between species, for instance. So there's a congener of this squirrel cuckoo here, the black-bellied cuckoo in one landscape and isn't in the other one. So it may be sort of a competition between species and ecological release between regions that can account for these differences. But again, they make building a model to try and understand how many birds you have difficult, because you can't physically go out and count, you know, all these species across the region. So you're there trying to build a reliable model to give out how many we have, which again is the sort of currency we need to be thinking about making these red list assessments. Again, with using the eBird data, then we can build sort of relative abundance maps, which are useful in terms of both priority setting and thinking about how many birds there might be, but we're still, you know, a few steps behind, I think, reliable population estimates for most Amazonian bird species. Indeed, we could be, you know, sort of orders of magnitude potentially out. So, anyone here speak Danish, by any chance? This is a famous Danish botanist, who was called Raunkier. I don't know if anyone can pronounce his name effectively. I'd just like to know, because I'm probably saying it wrong in every talk I give. So anyway, Raunkier's shortfall is sort of gaps in knowledge about species traits and ecological functions. So these five birds here are all small ant wrens. We've sort of mentioned these ant birds before. Ant birds are kind of a workhorse for lots of macrological studies. And all these five species here were historically all in the same genus. And indeed, they all look quite similar, but they all have very divergent life histories. And we know when we place on a phylogeny that actually a lot of them aren't particularly related at all. So we're seeing convergence on a phenotype, which looks quite similar, but you start actually measuring some of these differences in the thickness of their tarsus,
This thing's here is predominantly terrestrial, for instance, looking at life history. This is a canopy thing. This group here, the Epicanthala ant wrens, their only foraging maneuver is looking for insects in curled dead leaves. They do nothing else. So that's the sort of degree of specialism we see in these groups, and all members of this genus are obligate dead leaf foraging species. So again, thinking about that species packing, thinking about the realised niches of these birds, then that's why, you know, sort of tropical forests end up hemorrhaging so many species, because we see this, you know, extreme group of specialism. And again, sort of marrying then the phylogeny with the traits of these species is sort of opening up our eyes then to think about relationships between species, and talking a bit about competitive interactions between taxa, and thinking about the relative importance of those species within those ecosystems. So again, some work led by Tom Gregman, who's a PhD student of Natalie, who's here, and Joe's now at Imperial. We started using some of this trait data to look at bird traits, you know, across these gradients of forest degradation and in the regenerating secondary forests, and look at that sort of erosion then of the trait structure, and erosion of avian functional diversity in these landscapes. And hopefully, sort of our next step, we're sort of making inroads now, is to try and relate that back to sort of seed sizes, and relate those sort of trophic traits, sort of ecosystem processes in terms of seed dispersal, etc. So I think this is the final shortfall, biotic interaction. So again, what we know least about, right? So interactions between taxa. So this is a great paper from Annual Reviews from a few years ago, and it basically shows that any biotic interaction you can think of, essentially there's more of it in low latitudes in the tropics. There's a few things where we have a similar distribution. So just reading down here, we've got predation on birds' nests, interpredation on ants, endoparasites on marine fish, palatability of marine worms, salt marsh plants, mutualisms, etc. So we basically see lots more interactions in the tropics, which shouldn't come as a surprise given that diversity, and given that long history of stability, at which point these mutualisms and these interactions can essentially evolve. And the one that always blows my mind, this is the head of an Ecotombochelii army ant. And army ants, both in the neotropics and I guess driver ants as well in the afrotropics, are associated with lots and lots of other species. So I think there are 200 species that associate with these Ecotan army ants in the forest in the Amazon basin. Lots of army ant birds which follow the army ants. Their only foraging manoeuvre is foraging for prey flushed by this column of ants that moves through the forest. And then there is even an army ant skipper butterfly which only eats the poo of army ant birds. So you have like a third order interaction there. And again, the collapse then of army ants within small forest patches, because they are a super predator, they quickly go extinct because they quickly eat everything within those forest patches, you know, quickly results in the local extinction of these army ant birds, whose range sizes and effective population sizes are tied to those of the ants. And again, we see the co-extinction with the skippers, etc. And with the tropical birds, so there's some great work by Carl Mockross from the Large Numbers of Fragments project, showing there's all sorts of interactions with these mixed species flocks that we see in tropical forests. So if you go into tropical forests, anywhere in the tropics, you get these very, very temporally stable groups of birds. You have like a pair of each species normally moving through the forest in a big foraging wave. They all do things a bit differently, so they're not really in direct competition, and they benefit from reduction in predation, basically. So in the first year of their life, before they manage to join a mixed species flock, these birds, you know, are often predated. Once they've got flock membership, they basically, you know, have quite high annual survivorship. And indeed, many tropical birds have far, far higher sort of annual survivorship and far, far lower pace of life than temperate zone birds. So there's a lot of these small brown tropical forest birds can live for like 20 years or more, which is far, far longer. And that's a sort of temperate zone species, so different pace of life and different strategies. And we know then from looking at sort of composition of species within forest fragments that we can see evidence then of reduction in fragment size, basically triggering extinctions, probably again through competition, probably sort of same impacts happening then with through the degraded forests as well. So we're basically seeing extinctions being biased towards densely occupied regions of niche space, essentially. So I've gone on to think about some of these questions now about sort of these biotic interactions between taxa. I started doing some work in a bit of work both at temperate in and in tropical cities, and trying to think about the how interactions between bird species, basically when you have the potential to have one or two or three members of a genus, why do we get one, why do we get the other, and think about these checkerboard distributions of taxa between different areas. And we look for the first time then at the community composition of like an Amazonian megacity there in Belém, and show, for instance, that there was actually about 100 species that are regular in this tropical megacity, but that composition of species seemed to have very little to do with any other sort of habitat you can find outside. It sort of pulled some species in associated with vasia habitats. There were some open grasslands associated species coming in. It was like a potpourri of birds which managed to persist in this environment, an entirely sort of a new, sort of novel community. And then finally, in terms of biotic interaction, something we're working on again with colleagues recently at Cornell, we've been trying to understand how biotic interactions themselves influence not just what species occur where and when, but also what species even look like. So looking across the phylogeny of woodpeckers, looking at which woodpeckers occur where in space, understanding sort of climatic conditions and habitat conditions in that space, we're able to show, sort of looking into Gloge's rule, essentially, looking into the coloration of species between different habitats across different climatic boundaries, and beyond sort of the influence of climate and beyond the influence of habitat, we're also able to show a strong influence of sympatry, basically, of when species are co-occurring, it's driving, with many of these species, a form of mimicry. So we have like convergence on phenotype, which is probably being driven by biotic interactions. So interactions not only important in structuring what species occur where, but even what those species look like. And a final example, which always blows my mind away, does anyone know where that is? Eric and Mike? So this is a little island about 30 kilometres off the coast of Sao Paulo, and it's home to this endemic snake here. And it's been found that this endemic snake, the Beaufort's insularis, the golden lancehead, is entirely dependent on, one might call them vagrant birds. So these birds, which are migrating, these tyrant flycatchers I mentioned earlier on, doing these epic migrations from the southern cone region, Brazil and Argentina, moving up either to the kingdoms or Amazonia. Some of them get blown off course, land on a tiny little tropical island, where they're eaten by a snake, which apparently only eats for two seasons, only eats migrant or vagrant tropical birds. So I don't know, that always blows my mind as an example of like dependence, because there are other bird species which live there and they're never predated. There's a house wren, I think something else, and they've never been found in the stomach contents of the species. They obviously learn how to avoid this species. But the intercorrelation there, and imagine if you get a drop in abundance of those migrant species, would precipitate the extinction of this insular snake. So moral of the story then, lots of interactions between all those shortfalls. I'm not going to talk you through Hortle's graph there, looked at the paper, but if we don't know about one thing, that will impact on what we don't know about the next thing, and so on, in a cascading manner. And I guess what we really need to know then is be aware of what we don't know, right? Thoroughly conscious ignorance then, the prelude to every real advancement in science. And I guess also fighting then the sort of the non-conscious ignorance we're seeing out there when it comes to biodiversity loss and pushback against IPBS in the last few weeks too. Okay, so that was any questions?